sort of complementary way of looking at it is sort of the idea of integrability of the Killing Spinner equation, which leads to the notion of holonomy. And we talk about, you know, collodials with SC3 holonomy or things like that. I'd like to explain a little bit what that is. Today I'm basically going to talk about configurations without any fluxes turned on. Looks like Catherine Becker already beat me to the punch a little bit with her talk over here. So I'll spend about the first half talking a little bit about what we look for in terms of unbroken supersymmetry. And then in the second half, I'd like to actually get a little bit down and dirty, or at least to get to some explicit examples, as much as I can do like this. And we'll look at sort of the Euclidean top nut solution, which could be thought of as sort of a non-compact object with SE2 holonomy. And then also talk a little bit about what we mean by Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, things that people have been interested in somewhat recently. So to get started, as I said, we're talking about sort of explicit solutions, and the type of explicit solutions we're usually interested in are those that are actually supersymmetric. In the sort of original picture of string theory, if we wanted to make some connection from sort of 10-dimensional heterotic string to sort of supersymmetric theories in 4 dimensions, then the standard picture is to compactify on a collodial manifold. And so often, supersymmetric backgrounds, let's not forget, still have the sort of traditional idea of sort of backgrounds for string compactifications. And we can also do sort of string compactifications on manifolds with fluxes, which is also a possibility. The other thing is sometimes we might be interested in understanding a little bit more of the dynamics of M theory. And instead of just expecting to have M theory just sort of fall into place all at once, we might just sort of study corners of M theory using various dualities. And so one way to explore M theory and to learn some of the additional hidden symmetries is also to study certain vacuum configurations and supersymmetric configurations for M theory. That's also related to the idea of maybe classifying all supersymmetric vacua. And of course, I also mentioned, well, we've already learned quite a bit in terms of BPS objects. So not necessarily vacua, but BPS black holes, supersymmetric black holes, and we can understand quite a bit about black hole physics that way also. Sometimes I'll just use the same sort of terminology and say we're looking for supersymmetric vacua or configurations. On the other hand, sometimes people may make a distinction of looking for a vacuum state, something like Minkowski space or ADS times sphere configurations, which can serve as sort of a maximally symmetric background, or maybe a background with reduced supersymmetry. So you can think about supersymmetric vacua, which I think of as sort of a metric or gravity fields that's regular everywhere without any horizons. Or another possibility is to look at black holes or black brains or supergravity P brains, which would actually have horizons. Mostly what I'm going to talk about today fall into the class of just sort of vacuum type configurations. And when we start turning on charges, we can do the sort of mass equals charge or BPS type objects as well. So let's think a little bit about conditions for unbroken supersymmetry and what we mean to have a configuration that preserves some supersymmetries. Well, if I'm thinking, usually I talk in a very classical type language, but if we think a little bit from a field theory sort of point of view, we would like to imagine that there's a sort of a vacuum, and if the vacuum is symmetric, and we had a symmetry or supersymmetry, what I'm saying is a generator of the symmetries, which in this case would be the supercharge, acting on the vacuum, basically annihilates the vacuum. One immediate consequence of that is if I take any field in the theory and calculate sort of the commutator like that. Either Q is going to act on the left or act on the right, and that also will disappear. So we know that the commutator is also equal to zero. Now, of course, the commutator is exactly how you act to transform the field. So this really represents the transformation delta phi, if you wish. And what it says is sort of on the sort of vacuum background, what we're looking for is sort of a classical field configuration such that the supersymmetry variations of the fields have to vanish. So I showed you yesterday, and I guess you already knew it, of course, that if I look at supersymmetry, I can imagine taking a fermion and its transformation goes into a boson. Bosons transform into fermions. So if I take a natural point of view, I would say I don't want to turn on any fermions in the background. So I have a purely bosonic background. In that case, if I look over here, then supersymmetry on the bosons transform into fermions, but if I don't have any background fermions, then this second condition here is basically trivial. What that means is we tend to look only at the fermion variations. And so to find a supersymmetric solution, basically we just want to find a bosonic field configuration such that delta and the fermions, the fermion variations, will vanish. Now, unfortunately, these supersymmetry variations do depend on what theory you're looking at, what dimension, what n extension, and things like that. But generically, in the supergravity theory, there's always going to be a gravitino variation. So I'm just listing, for example, there's a graviton or a wheelbine over here, and its variation is related to the gravitino. And at the same time, the gravitino variation is related in a way to the wheelbine. You have to remember there's a spin connection inside here, which is basically a derivative on the wheelbine or derivative of a boson. So if I just look at that sort of system, of course, I wrote in pale blue, delta lambda, something like that, it's also possible that there are additional fields in the theory, but there should at least be the graviton. And what we want to do is just to solve that the gravitino variation vanishes, so delta epsilon, grad epsilon equals zero. For 11-dimensional supergravity, this supercovariant derivative I wrote down over here is the standard covariant derivative plus terms dependent on the four-form field strength, which will play an important role in some later discussions. But for today, if we just focus on the background metric or a purely geometric type solution, then all we want to do is solve grad epsilon equals zero. And you know basically what that means. In flat space, it just says d mu epsilon equals zero. Epsilon is a constant spinner. In curved space, we say it's a covariantly constant spinner. And this is known as the Killing spinner equation, or perhaps the parallel spinner equation. And part of the reason we call it that is if you remember, if you have sort of bosonic isometries or symmetries of the manifold, then they're related to Killing vectors. And likewise, if I had sort of a fermionic symmetry or a supersymmetry, they're related to this sort of equation here, which we call the Killing spinner equation. So it sounds pretty simple. We just want to solve that equation, but it turns out it can be a little bit subtle. Yeah. In some cases, it might be possible. Well, for this, I'm not sure I want to set the bosonic fields equal to, all of them equal to zero per se, but just to some simple Minkowski space background or something like that. But the assumption over here is that the fermions do not really, because they're fermions, you can't just sort of superpose them, so they don't really condense on your background. So you cannot necessarily have a sort of a classical fermionic type background. You can discuss that a little bit more through a quantum mechanical language, of course, but I think mostly it's just a bosonic background. So for today, I want to look more or less just at the simple case where we just look at the metric, basically, just the purely sort of geometric type solutions. And what we want to do is to find sort of conditions or cases where we can find this covariantly constant spinner. Now, just as a side remark, this covariantly constant spinner might be something we look for in 10 dimensions or 11 dimensions, but we actually don't have to solve sort of for a supersymmetric background in all of space-time. And in like the heterotic string or other string compactifications, what you can typically do is take, let's say, your 10-dimensional space-time, break it up into four-dimensional space plus the six-dimensional internal manifold. Now, what you would do is look for Killing spinners basically on the internal manifold only. And the sort of supersymmetries, or the Killing spinners of the internal manifold, also relate to sort of the number of supersymmetries that are preserved in space-time. And this is why we would look for sort of SC3 holonomy or Calabi-Yau manifold, so that we can actually preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry for heterotic strains. Well, part of the difficulty with just looking at the Killing spinner equation by itself is it's a differential equation. It's a differential equation that depends on the metric, and then it acts on the spinner. You say it's a first order equation, which is maybe better than equations of motion, which are second order equations. But nevertheless, it's a little bit awkward. So one thing you can actually do is to check sort of what's known as the integrability condition. This says if grad epsilon equals 0, then if one derivative on epsilon equals 0, then obviously two derivatives on epsilon also have to vanish. If two derivatives vanish, the commutator of two derivatives vanish. And just from general relativity, this commutator here just measures the curvature encoded in the Riemann tensor. So that gives you some expression like that. So another way to understand the conditions on unbroken spinner, for unbroken supersymmetry, is the existence of a spinner satisfying this sort of equation over here. This is actually a pretty strong equation. One thing is I have not even said anything about equations of motion. I just said we're looking for a covariantly constant spinner. One thing you can do is play a little trick. If this Riemann expression is true, I can hit it on the left with another gamma matrix, gamma nu, over here. And now I have, there's two gamma matrices antisymmetrized here on rho and sigma, and one more over here. I can do some Dirac type identities. I can relate that to three fully antisymmetrized gamma matrices plus sort of a one gamma matrix term. Hidden inside here, I've actually used the antisymmetry property of Riemann. And then you know there's a Bianchi identity that says if you antisymmetrize Riemann on three indices, that vanishes. And so you're left with basically just Ricci times gamma times epsilon. So this is carrying less information than the integrability condition, but this turns out to be a useful equation over here because it almost looks like the vacuum Einstein equation. I'm thinking, I haven't turned on any background matter fields, so you would expect just vacuum Einstein. And so it's sort of logically consistent that that's what you get. In fact, in some cases, you can do better. For example, if you had a completely supersymmetric background, then I'm thinking that there exists, you know, 32 preserved supercharges or something like that. But that means for complete supersymmetry, basically epsilon can be an arbitrary constant spinner. And if this R mu nu gamma nu epsilon vanishes for more or less any epsilon, that means I can remove the epsilon. I just said R mu nu gamma nu as a matrix equation equals to 0. And from the matrix equation, it's very easy to extract R mu nu equals 0. And just one sort of way to do that is to realize you can just multiplied by another independent gamma matrix, take the trace, and you'll find R mu nu equals 0. So if you have complete supersymmetry, then we've just demonstrated that this implies the equations of motion. It turns out, and it's a bit of a subtle issue, that if we had partially broken supersymmetry, which is what we're usually interested in, some fraction of supersymmetry, then it tends to imply a subset of the equations of motion, and not necessarily all of them. One way to see that is if we assume there's only one Killing spinner, then somehow we want to remove this gamma nu epsilon from this equation just to say R mu nu equals 0. But it's a little difficult to remove all of R gamma nu epsilon if we exist, if we only know that a single Killing spinner exists. Yes? Equations of motion. That actually, that I believe is actually true. And in some sense, the commutator over here of the two supersymmetries gives you basically, it should close on the complete set of bosonic equations of motion in certain combinations. And what you need to do is extract them sort of independently of each other. So you'd get the Einstein equation, some Maxwell equation, Dilaton equation, things like that. And they tend to come in with different sort of Dirac structure. And Maxwell's supersymmetry tells you basically all those independent structures have to vanish by themselves. Now, I don't know if that's ultimately true for every theory you can write down, but I believe it is. It also tends not to be completely interesting in many cases, but it is kind of interesting that, for example, in 11 dimensions, there's a complete classification of maximally supersymmetric backgrounds. Let's consider how much of the equations of motion we can actually get back to our sort of simple example, where there's no form fields turned on. So we have this equation, R mu nu gamma nu epsilon equals 0. Well, mu is a free index. Let me just be a little bit more specific and fix it. Let me call it mu 0, because I just decided to fix that index. Maybe mu 0 equals index number 2 or something like that. That's a little trick you could play. If I do that, then more or less we know R mu nu gamma nu epsilon equals 0. I can multiply that with sort of another R mu nu gamma nu if I wanted to. 0 times something else is still equal to 0. And let me remind you, I'm not summing over the index mu naught over there. That's just number 2 or something that I'm going to leave alone. Nevertheless, once I do that, you can realize that this is basically symmetric on the first and the second Ricci over here. So these two Dirac matrices are basically anti-symmetrized. Or, sorry, I mean symmetrized, which is just the Clifford algebra. That gives you G nu rho metric. And when I contract the second index of each Ricci with the inverse metric, basically all I'm doing is calculating the norm of R mu naught, where it's viewed as a vector in the second index, and the first index mu naught is just some label attached to it. Well, we know in Euclidean signature, the norm over here has to be, sort of, for a positive definite metric, this is the sum of squares, basically. So in order for this to be equal to 0, each individual term has to be equal to 0. And when you think about that, and you think it through, and you realize this is true for all mu naughts, this actually implies R mu nu equals 0. So this says, for Euclidean signature, the preservation of even one supersymmetry is enough to guarantee the equations of motion, which is a pretty reasonable result. But sort of the flaw in the argument is if I looked at a Lorentzian type signature, then, whoops, sorry. shouldn't talk so much. So anyway, in the Lorentzian signature, when I square something with the Lorentzian norm, then I could have a sum of positive terms and negative terms cancel each other out. So that shows you have to be a little bit more careful sometimes with your equations of motion. Yes? In some sense, there are. I'm not sure if it's a very useful sort of thing. But a lot of these BPS brains, which are built out of harmonic superpositions, if you actually look carefully at what supersymmetry is telling you, it says there's sort of a what I would call a harmonic function. They're basically just a function that goes in front of the metric, goes in front of the form fields and things like that. The reason it's a harmonic function is because it has to satisfy a Laplace's equation or something. And if you think about it, that Laplace's equation, the second order equation, comes from posing either a Bianchi identity or some equation of motion. So you've had to add, when I say Bianchi identity, I'm calling that a little bit as an equation of motion. And so you need that extra input. It's basically supersymmetry implies sort of a linear combination of equations of motion. And it's a bit of a subtle issue that I've actually had some arguments about with various issues of whether you have sources to fix that up or not. That's going to go astray a little bit. Good. Anyway, for another way to look at this, the integrability of the Killing spin, or the commutator of two covariant derivatives, is basically the reason why the commutator gives you the Riemann tensor. It basically represents sort of failure of your sort of parallel transport to just sort of preserve sort of the direction of a vector or a spinner in this case. So basically, this commutator can be thought of as representing an infinitesimal sort of parallel transport of a spinner around a little loop specified by the new directions. And so this introduces the notion of holonomy. If I can imagine taking a spinner and just transporting it around various closed cycles, then in the curved space, it doesn't always have to sort of transport back into itself. It could come back, sort of rotate it. And the rotations have to be sort of contained inside sort of the tangent space of the manifold. And so I can express this as basically a rotation generator acting on the spinner. And all these different rotations form a group. And it should be very natural, because if I just sort of compose two different circles or two different paths together, that's just sort of the act of group multiplication. So another way to look at that is, yes? Torsion free. This I'm considering torsion free right now, but I don't know. Once you break the supersymmetry. Quite possibly. But right now, this is all, yeah, I think you're right. But right now, I'm just thinking about just sort of pure geometry without any torsion. And so within that sort of restricted class, it's just that. So the group of rotations acting on the spinner, I can call it H, for example, forms a group. It has to be a subgroup of the tangent space group. And so then what you realize is that an unbroken supersymmetry basically means the spinner is not going to be rotated under the holonomy group. And so I'm basically looking for a decomposition of the spinner into singlets under the holonomy group. So the number of singlets, or number of components of the spinner that are not rotated, correspond to the number of unbroken supersymmetries. And so I like to mention, in sort of standard Riemannian geometry, Euclidean signature, the use of holonomy to classify all these manifolds is well understood. It's sort of a nice result by Berger that showed that at least for some class of manifolds, these irreducible, so they're not like direct product manifolds, non-symmetric, which means they're not sort of coset or homogeneous spaces. These sort of Riemannian metrics, the holonomy of the metric only falls into a few classes, which is this table over here. And let me just quickly sketch through this table. The first line over here, SON for a n-dimensional Euclidean manifold, is basically just a generic metric without any particular symmetries you've imposed on that. That's just a tangent space group, or a group of rotations. You can have UN inside a 2n-dimensional manifold, and that turns out to be a complex Kähler manifold. So it has a covariantly constant Kähler form. If you specialize that a little bit further, SUN holonomy is Ricci flat in Kähler, which is the Clavial case. You can also have the symplectic structure, which is hyper-Kähler. Quaternionic Kähler is kind of not really Kähler, but called quaternionic Kähler. And then the interesting cases, G2 and spin 7, are known as exceptional holonomy. They refer to 7- and 8-dimensional manifolds exclusively. But because of that, when you say sort of a G2 manifold or something, you don't even have to say a 7-dimensional manifold of G2 holonomy. That's implicitly understood. Now, I mentioned that in this Euclidean case, if you have preserved supersymmetry, then you have to satisfy the vacuum-Einstein equation, which is just R mu nu equals 0. That's just the Ricci flat condition. Turns out the four cases I've listed over here correspond to Ricci flat manifolds. So from the holonomy point of view, that means the spinner has to decompose to yield singlets in these sort of cases. So I'd like to just give a few examples. Oh, yes. This is, to be honest, I don't think it does. I think there's probably some subtleties in that, but it does depend on Euclidean signature. There's some simply connected stuff also, and I don't remember the fine points, actually. I'm sorry? Or interval, but, oh, they take you outside of this category, you're saying. So they're orientable. Yeah, I guess that's right. You mean the sort of S part of SON. Well, probably the simplest example would be just flat space. That is a possibility, of course. And in flat space, basically, covariant derivative, just the ordinary derivative. And this is what I mentioned before. It just says the spinner has to be a constant. And if we wanted to, we can consider this as 100% of the original supersymmetry is preserved, or sort of the fraction of supersymmetry is just one. We usually don't say that, but if you wanted to, you could. Later on, you could say a half, quarter, one-eighth, and things like that. And you can imagine, you could take a commutator of two of these sort of ordinary derivatives, and then you just, ordinary derivatives are supposed to commute with each other, and so the commutator, or the integrability, is trivially satisfied. That basically says it has trivial holonomy, And if you want to be a little bit more explicit, you can imagine writing out a basis for your killing spinners, where I just think about a spinner in some number of components, either the first component's turned on, second one, third one, and so on. As you can see over here, it's sort of the number of actual supersymmetries, or the number of spinners you have, depends on the dimension, depends on whether you're counting Dirac spinners, or real spinners, or things like that. But nevertheless, it's 100% preserved in whatever theory you're talking about. A little more interesting to consider SU2 holonomy. This is for a four-dimensional manifold. The tangent space group is normally SO4, which is basically two copies of SU2. And it's convenient to denote that SU2 plus and SU2 minus. If I look at the holonomy type, the integrability condition, or the holonomy thing over here, I can play a bit of a trick. This is four dimensions. In four dimensions, I can introduce gamma 5. So I can add and subtract gamma 5. I've basically just done an identity type operation over here. Tried to write it in a somewhat more fancy way, 1 plus gamma 5 and 1 minus gamma 5. But once I've written it in this fashion, this should remind you of sort of left and right-handed chirality projections. I'm thinking in Euclidean space over here, but the idea is basically the same as left and right sort of handed chiralities. The fun thing about this is if I have gamma 5 acting on antisymmetric gamma AB, there's a sort of a gamma 5 type identity that introduces the epsilon tensor. And so if I sort of replace this gamma 5 gamma AB with the epsilon tensor, then I can also take the epsilon tensor and pull it onto the Riemann tensor. So basically, I realize the decomposition into what I call R plus and R minus over here, where R plus and R minus are basically self-dual and anti-self-dual on the last two indices of Riemann. Now, you should know in four dimensions, when I talk about self-dual and anti-self-dual, as ordinary self and anti-self-duals, this applies in Euclidean space, where star star equals plus 1 instead of minus 1. So these are sort of Euclidean self-dual configurations. Now, self-dual Yang-Mills configurations are basically known as instantons. Here, it's a self-dual sort of Riemann or a self-dual gravity type configuration. And so some people will call these things gravitational instantons, if you wish. So the way to find a killing spinner is, because I have sort of left and right-handed chiralities, I can basically pick a self-dual connection. And then if I use a self-dual connection, that only term that survives is the R plus over here acting on this T minus projection. What that means is if I pick a spinner that is annihilated by P minus, then I automatically satisfy this condition. So it's kind of cute. It shows you that the killing spinners, in some sense, tend to be chiral killing spinners that are sort of killed by one of these types of projections. There's sort of different ways of looking at it. From a holonomy point of view, I'm asking how does the spinner sort of transform under this, this sort of expression. What happens is this gamma AB P minus object basically satisfies the Lie algebra of SU2. This gamma AB P minus is very explicitly your SU2 minus subgroup of SO4. And so you can imagine the decomposition of the four-component spinner into a doublet plus a singlet plus a singlet under the SO4 breaks to SU2 sort of classification. So two singlets out of four is a preserving half of the supersymmetries. The killing spinner language is sort of opposite of that. It says, if this is a condition I satisfy, then epsilon should satisfy, basically epsilon plus, the positive chirality spinners, or the killing spinners, they're the ones which make this equation basically disappear. Now, the other spinners that are not annihilated, the ones that transform as a doublet over here, are actually kind of interesting, because they are basically fermion zero mode spinners, and they will actually, if you imagine transforming your background with one of these zero modes, then you will get a supersymmetric configuration in some sense with fermions turned on. And this basically just realizes a representation of the supersymmetry algebra on your background. That says you actually form generally a shortened multiplicative supersymmetry. So a compact manifold with SU2 holonomy is basically the K3 surface. And I think Paul Aspinwall already talked about that. So I'm not going to say anything about K3. What I'd like to do is to give you a few explicit examples. And to be a little more explicit, I'd like to actually write down honest metrics. One of the problems with compact manifolds is it tends to be hard to write these metrics down. You might know K3 and orbifold limits, plus you blow up the singular points or things like that. But part of the reason it's difficult is because, you know, if you knew part of the metric or some curvature over here, to have a compact manifold, you really need to know that everything sort of closes and gives you a sort of a smooth geometry in the end. You can also write down non-compact examples with non-trivial holonomy, and then it's sort of simpler to be explicit in that case. And just for example, there's the sort of Euclidean tab-nup solution. This shows up in some sense from the lifting of D6 brains, if you wish. This is a four-dimensional solution, which I can write in spherical coordinates, dr squared plus sort of a two sphere over here, plus a U1 fiber bundled over the sphere. And this is sort of an asymptotically locally flat solution. We say it's locally flat because at infinity, as r goes to infinity, basically this is just flat three-dimensional space, and this becomes a circle direction. The other example would be sort of the Yaguchi-Hansen space, which is asymptotically locally Euclidean. And if you look at this metric over here with this little h function, as you go to infinity, h goes to 1, you get something that looks just like dr squared plus, and this turns out to be a 3-sphere, except to be non-singular as you shrink your r, this order angle psi, which normally should have a 4-pi period, is now taking on a 2-pi period. So you end up with r4 mod z2 type geometry at infinity. So we'll come back to the Talbot solution, but the other point of view to look at is SU3 holonomy. And this shows up in sort of Calabi-Yau complex threefolds. Maybe I won't spend much time on this. Just to mention the SO6 tangent space group is basically isomorphic to SU4. And then you look for a SO6 tangent space group. It's a complex manifold. So that brings you down to a U3 structure. And then on top of that, it's SU3 holonomy for Calabi-Yau. The four-component spinner decomposes into 3 plus 1. So this turns out to be a 1/4 BPS background. Well, let me pause just briefly, because after this, I'll just work out a few examples. All right, so I guess a couple of transparencies ago, I showed you the it's very simple Talbot metric, and I claim that has SU2 holonomy. It's a half BPS object. I like to look at that, and this arises, for example, in the sixth brain, which if you take the 2A theory to be sort of reduced from 11 dimensions, if you lift it back up, the D6 brain is charged under the Ramond-Ramond vector, which is sort of the gauging of the U1 circle take you down to 10 dimensions. When you lift it back up, you end up with a U1 fiber over here bundled over the three-dimensional base. A typical solution here can be a multi-centered solution. So what I really want to do is focus not on the metric I wrote down before, but on this multi-centered top-nut type expression. Let me just present the solution. This is, again, pure geometry in 11 dimensions, or rather this four-dimensional part of it. H turns out to be a harmonic function. It satisfies basically box H equals 0 in the three-dimensional space over here. A over here is a Kaluza-Klein gauge field with field strength F equals dA, and it turns out that F has to be the Hausdrell of dH in the three-dimensional base. So I want to examine the supersymmetry of this line element. Basically. And the way to do that is to actually look at the Killing-Spinner equation. So what I want to do is to solve grad epsilon equals 0. That means we really need to look at the covariant derivative in this slightly more non-trivial background. The way to do that is to express the covariant derivative in terms of the spin connection. And the spin connection, that means we need to sort of learn how to calculate the spin connection. There are different ways to do that. One way to do it is to realize, well, what I mean by the spin connection is you introduce a Willebine basis, which means E, the Willebine, is basically the square root of the metric. And then I need to satisfy the torsion precondition, or the Cartan structure equation, which is just basically dE plus omega. I need to satisfy the torsion precondition, d omega, dE plus omega wedge E equals 0. One way to do that is to understand what dE looks like. So you can write down dE in terms of E can be viewed as a one-form basis, and dE is a two-form, which can be re-expressed in terms of EB wedge EC with sort of Cartan or anholonomy coefficient C over here. And I'm just giving you the answer, basically. It says if you can do that, then you can express the spin connection in flat space indices in terms of this combination over here. Again, the best thing is not to trust me, but to actually work it out yourself. I do want to highlight a cute little thing. Normally, you calculate the spin connection, and it's a bit of a mess, and you have curved space and flat space indices to worry about. It tends to scare people off a little bit, because it seems to be more complicated than the Christoffel connection. On the other hand, if you had a diagonal metric, this is not the most general thing, but if you had a diagonal metric, there's a little shortcut that can be taken. And so if they had a diagonal metric, they can imagine writing each Willebine in terms of just a single function, f mu times delta mu alpha, if you wish. And if you do that, plug it into these equations, you work it out, what you find is this is the formula I like to remember, omega mu nu lambda. This is all expressed as curved space indices now. It's basically just g mu nu comma lambda, where comma represents partial derivative. Now, of course, the spin connection is antisymmetric in the last two indices, so I just put antisymmetrization over there, but I just write omega mu nu lambda is g mu nu comma lambda. That's how I sort of remember that equation, but of course it means to antisymmetrize. Now, you have to be a little bit careful that this only legitimately works for diagonal metrics. Unfortunately, we don't have a diagonal metric over here, so you have to basically just work it out a little bit. For these U1 bundles, there's a very natural Willebine basis where this dy plus a basically serves as your fourth Willebine. And I could recommend this as just a quick little exercise. It's not too difficult, but if you work it out, what you realize, and it's not a surprising thing, is you express the spin connection in terms of metric components, and the metric depends on H and the Kaluza-Klein gauge field A. So the field bindings have derivatives of H's, DH's, or basically FABs, which is the field strength constructed from the Kaluza-Klein vector. And what you do is you put that together into the covariant derivative, and you end up with two equations that must be satisfied, basically grad m, where m I'm just going to call 1, 2, 3, the base indices. And then you also have grad y, which is the derivative along the fiber. The covariant derivatives are always ordinary derivatives plus connection sort of stuff. Turns out that you can express the connections either in xm over here or x4 over here. And this is just by putting those spin connections together and multiplying it with gamma matrices. And there's a little bit of a pattern to this type of solution. You have the function h over here, and you have the field strength fab in a way, both over here and here. You have one term with h, one term with f. You can play a trick to highlight that a little bit better. I can factor out something like a gamma A4 or something over here, where I have FAB plus epsilon ABC DCH times gamma 5. Gamma 5 is just the chirality thing in the Euclidean space. And in either case, for the m derivative or the 4 derivative, you realize I can read this thing off as basically f over here and star dh, if you wish, or dh and star f, where star is just a three-dimensional Hodge dual. Somehow, in order to have zero eigenvalues of this matrix, I need to have a balance between f and dh. And this is exactly where that f equals star dh condition, this f equals star dh sort of comes out. So you see, if you impose that, I can rewrite the covariant derivatives in terms of ordinary derivatives plus certain expressions that are not too pretty, but all multiplied by a P plus projection over here, where again, these are the standard chirality projections. This, in some sense, just verifies what I talked about in a more generic setting when I talked about the SE2 holonomy case. This is the explicit example where you really see the P plus and P minus conditions come out. So this tells you that we need this F equals star DH type condition to preserve supersymmetry. The other thing is you can go back to Bianchi identity, DF equals zero, which tells you D star DH equals zero, which is three-dimensional Laplacian on H equals zero. That tells you H can be a harmonic superposition, which is the very standard picture. So I guess I already mentioned, you can see how this is related to the SE2 holonomy, because you have this sort of gamma AB P plus type projection. And it has the familiar 4 goes to 2 plus 1 plus 1. Decomposition. So the basics over here is you tend to end up with these sort of projections acting on killing spinners. And for the simple thing, there's this one projection that gives you a half BPS solution. In other geometries, you might end up, say, with perpendicular intersecting brains or something like that, with two projections, one related to each brain, and that would give something like a quarter BPS. You get three projections, you get 1/8 BPS, as long as they're mutually commuting projections. Of course, that's sort of a familiar case. Another way to look at the Taubnut solution is, let me go back to the sort of single charged Taubnut. And so instead of writing it in terms of some harmonic function over a base, let me just write it with a more explicit sphere over here, and plus the fiber like that. This has sort of three angles, theta, phi, and psi. This is a two-dimensional sphere. And then there's another sort of psi angle that looks like a U1 fiber. Well, of course, turns out you can write a three-sphere as sort of U1 bundled over S2. I can also write a three-sphere in terms of what are known as these left invariant one forms, satisfying basically the SU2 algebra. This is related to SO4 decomposing into two SU2s. And so that single-centered top-knot solution can be written kind of like that. Now, if I didn't have these H functions and things like that in front of it, if I had just had 1/4 sigma 1 squared plus sigma 2 squared plus sigma 3 squared, that gives you a round three-sphere. What this looks like in some languages is I sort of squashed or distorted the three-sphere. I've taken the sigma 3 element and sort of given it a different factor compared to sigma 1 and sigma 2. This is useful sometimes in how we can examine and try to construct new solutions by taking a well-known solution, like a round phi-sphere or a round seven-sphere or something like that, and finding ways to do some sort of squashing on that. This is also supposed to remind you, if I forget about the details, it looks kind of like I have a dr squared plus a three-dimensional sphere, at least vaguely something like that. I can make it a little bit more concrete by saying if I wanted to consider metrics that look like dr squared plus r squared times a sphere or some other base type manifold, I can do so. This looks kind of like a radius coordinate plus angles or spheres or something like that. And r goes basically from 0 to infinity, the way I wrote that. This is known as something like a cone. It's basically a cone over a base manifold x. That's because the tip of the cone is at r equals 0, where this term over here shrinks to 0 volume. So it's extremely useful to consider these sort of cones. And one thing we can try to do is relate the sort of d-dimensional manifold over here with the d minus one dimensional base. So I'd like to show you kind of how that works. And this comes up to sort of what we call Sasaki-Einstein manifold. Well, I'm thinking about supersymmetry over here. So let's just take this cone metric over here. And let's compute basically the Killing-Spinner equation or the covariant derivative in d dimensions. What you can do is break it up into sort of the base over here. And I have gamma matrices, gamma m or gamma a on the base. And then I have another gamma matrix, which would be gamma, I call it r bar, if you wish, or gamma with the radius sort of thing. It turns out, because the metric is simple enough, I'm assuming that the radius r shows up only with this r squared term over here. You can express the spin connections in d dimensions in terms of the d minus one dimensional spin connection. And this guy over here turns out just to be the d minus one Biot-Bye. That tells you that the d-dimensional covariant derivative, grad r, is just partial r. And if I want this to be equal to 0, it just says the spinner has to be independent of the r direction. Meanwhile, grad along the base directions, grad m, is the same as the covariant derivative on x, plus an additional term over here that came because of the r squared factor. This additional term is very interesting. It's a modification to the spinner equation. That turns out to be basically a Killing-Spinner equation on a sphere, or if I analytically continued that, that's also the Killing-Spinner equation in an anti-de Sitter space. It's a little bit more non-trivial, so I want to call that sort of curly D, dm epsilon equals 0, where this sort of generalized D is the whole expression. If I do that and search for Killing spinners, then again, integrability comes to our assistance. If we do that, we end up with two terms, the ordinary commutator term plus the commutator of the Dirac matrices. The covariant derivative commutes with the Dirac matrices. There's only these two things over here. That again gives you the familiar Riemann, but the second term gives you basically antisymmetric gamma mn. And if I wanted to factor it out, I can write out something of that nature. Multiplying it once more by gamma n gives you just like what we did before, but with the extra term, it'll give you Ricci minus something proportional to gmn. If I want this acting on epsilon equals to zero, it basically tells you rmn minus lambda gmn equals zero. That's telling you that the space is Einstein. So we learned from the Killing Spinner equation, basically, that this base, xd minus 1, has to be Einstein with a particular cosmological constant related to d minus 2, like that. Now, of course, this number d minus 2 is not super important. I can sort of, that's because I've chosen, in some sense, dr squared plus r squared times something. I want the something to be basically a unit radius something. Of course, that's not the complete answer. The space should not be just Einstein, but I still need the existence of the Killing Spinner. The fun thing is if I assume the Einstein condition, and then I plug it back in here, the Einstein condition relates Ricci to the metric, or these metrics can be related to the Ricci tensor. If I look at it carefully, this combination here turns out to be exactly the same combination as the Weyl tensor. So I can express integrability in terms of vanishing Weyl tensor times gamma pq on epsilon. In a way, you can think about this as a Weyl holonomy or something like that, and then in order to preserve supersymmetry, this condition here has to be satisfied. And basically, when all is said and done, we have, if we have supersymmetry given by these two conditions on the base, then we also have supersymmetry on the cone, or it's a relation that says the d-dimensional manifold is supersymmetric, and in particular, if that's Ricci, flat, and Kähler, which is the Calabi-Yau case, then the base space has to be Einstein manifold with preserving a Killing spinner over here, and that's more or less known as a Sasaki-Einstein manifold. So you say if you have a Sasaki-Einstein base, then the cone over that is Calabi-Yau. Well, Sasaki-Einstein sounds kind of fancy, but the simplest example would be just a sphere. A cone over a round sphere is basically just spherical coordinates. And so if I just chose a sphere like that, dr squared plus r squared d omega squared is flat space, and flat space will preserve all supersymmetries. That's perhaps a little bit too trivial. It's a little bit more interesting to imagine if I didn't have a sphere, what kind of manifold, what can I say about this base x d minus 1? Well, one thing is these Sasaki-Einstein metrics, because they admit a Killing spinner, it turns out they also admit a Killing vector. And you can form a Killing vector out of a bilinear into Killing spinners. And so if I specialize a coordinate system, I can write down the Killing vector in terms of basically d by d psi, where I've specialized psi to be a sort of a U1 type direction. That means the Sasaki-Einstein metric manifold itself, I'm taking this to be odd dimensional, like a five-dimensional Sasaki-Einstein space, can be written where I've pulled out a specialized U1 direction as a U1 bundled over the four-dimensional base over here. And it turns out that this base over here has to be Einstein, like a sphere or something like that, but also has to be Kähler, so it's Kähler-Einstein base over here. You bundle U1 over here, that gives you a five-dimensional Sasaki-Einstein space. You put a cone on top of that, and then you get six-dimensional, sort of non-compact version of Calabi-Yau. So a familiar example here would be T11 space. This is sort of part of a class of, I think, of five-dimensional spaces over here. This is what shows up in the conifold. T11 space, and let me start with TPQ. TPQ is written as basically U1 bundled over S2 times S2. I have the two sphere, which is just d theta squared plus sine squared theta the pi square for the first sphere and another one for the second sphere. And the trick for doing that is each of them can have maybe possibly independent cosmological constants. And I have d psi over here, which is a U1 direction, which I turn on a sort of a Kaluza-Klein-like or a gauge field over here, which lives on the S2 times S2 base over here. You can see explicitly if I calculate F equals dA, it's just basically the volume forms on these individual two spheres. And in some sense, I can wrap it sort of P times on the first sphere and Q times on the second sphere. That's what these integers P and Q are. Before looking at supersymmetry, I'd say I want this to be five-dimensional Einstein. That's one of the conditions we need. It has to be five-dimensional Einstein. Well, you can just compute the five-dimensional Ricci curvature. And I cheated. I just grabbed this from Candelas's paper. But it's basically RAB on the first sphere, R sort of A tilde B tilde on the second sphere, and then in the phi-phi direction. You can imagine if I don't have any bundle or fiber or anything like that, this is just curvature is given by lambda 1, this guy is given by lambda 2. Because of the sort of bundle structure, you get these additional correction terms showing up. But you can see these are sort of just, well, kind of nonlinear, but at least algebraic equations that you can always choose these three constants to get a five-dimensional Einstein space. Turns out, however, that only P equals 1 and Q equals 1 is supersymmetric. And I just wrote down the explicit metric over here with the 1/6 and 1/9 factors just to be complete. This turns out to be basically a homogeneous space, also written as sort of SE2 cross SE2 over U1. One thing you can look at is the sort of isometries of this space. It looks like I have a sphere over here and another sphere and a U1. But because of the 1-1 or the bundle sort of structure, it preserves sort of an SE2 combination over here and a U1 and U1 isometries. That means sort of the generic orbit of a point on the manifold under the isometry groups lets you move sort of along this U1 circle, along sort of the SU2s. So the generic orbit of a point under the isometry group fills out four dimensions out of five, which is basically codimension one. This is also known as cohomogeneity one in this case. A sort of in some cases, these cohomogeneity one type objects tend to be the easiest ones to find explicit solutions or explicit expressions for. Some cohomogeneity two objects are known as well. I'm going to get out of the scope of my lectures, but let me just mention that the cone over T11 is basically known as the conifold. And cones over anything other than the round sphere is singular at the tip of the cone. That's kind of obvious because you have a shrinking sort of base manifold. If it doesn't shrink correctly, then you end up with sort of a curvature singularity where everything collapses to the point. Topologically, T11 is S2 times S3, so you have both two cycles and three cycles collapsing at the tip of the cone. Work that takes you can get outside of sort of the cone in some size by doing deformations or resolutions. And that's a very interesting story. But what I'd like to do is more or less finish up by highlighting that recently there's been some additional infinite families of Sasaki-Einstein manifolds that have been constructed. And these are known as YPQ spaces. I wrote down sort of the metric over here. Again, it's a five-dimensional metric. If you compare it to T11 space, you'll still see over here d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. That is sort of the first S2. So T11, the way I wrote it down, was U1 bundled over S2 times S2. Here, I still have the first S2. The second S2, well, I've introduced coordinates or they've introduced coordinates y and beta. That's not entirely obvious that it's s2, but this makes it a little bit more interesting. And then I have the psi fiber as well. This works out as a solution when these functions w and v over here take on these expressions where there are two constants, a and c. As long as the constant c is not equal to 0, you can rescale the y-coordinate, basically, to scale out c to make c equals 1. But if the constant c is equal to 0, then it's sort of different. One way to see that is that this cubic term, cy cubed over here, if I set c equals 0, I've gotten rid of the cubic term. And if you do that, if you set c equals 0, this actually gets much simpler, 1/6 times this the omega 2 squared thing over here. These expressions simplify, but pick a equals 3, then it gets sort of like 1 minus y squared dy squared expressions like that. And basically, when I take c equals 0, this expression, a few of these things all disappear. And it shouldn't be too hard to see that that just gives you back t11. So in fact, this contains t11, but has additional generalization. The reason it's called PQ is not because I've written down A and C over here. We have to do a little bit of analysis to see that there are certain conditions on E and C that ought to be satisfied to guarantee that you have a smooth and a regular manifold. One thing is the y-coordinate would be restricted over here between, this is a cubic expression, and you restrict it between the two roots. And then usually interesting things happen when y approaches the first root. This is the negative root, or if y approaches the least positive root, because this function goes to 0, these expressions sort of go to 0. So you have some cycle or something that's shrinking, and you have to make sure to shrink things correctly. And so it turns out to be just a discrete family of regular solutions known as YPQ. Another way to look at it is to make sure you have the right periods over S2 and S2. Why not? Let's see. This is sort of topologically S2 times S2. And I think about S2 as a north pole and a south pole sort of thing. So beta can be thought of as, well, it's, maybe it's twisted, but it's roughly, beta can be roughly thought of as a, you know, phi or as a Muther angle. And then this WV thing goes to 0 here, which I can think of as a north pole, and goes to 0 on the other side, which I think of as a south pole. And if you get them to sort of join correctly at those places, then these two terms here, more or less, is something like your second S2. Topologically, this whole five-dimensional thing is still S2 times S3, which is probably not so obvious. Well, I won't really write down this example over here. Not too long ago, some other people wrote down what they call LPQR space. This is yet another sort of generalization of the YPQ spaces. Sometimes finding explicit solutions is a little tricky, and you can imagine just writing out all these nonlinear coupled differential equations in multiple variables, and you're not exactly sure what to make of it. So often it's nice to sort of find tricks for generating new sort of solutions. It turns out that you can get the YPQ spaces by starting, this is five dimensions. You can start with something like a rotating black hole in ADS. ADS has sort of negative curvature. But then you can do sort of an analytic continuation trick to continue from sort of negative lambda into positive lambda. So you can end up with sort of a five-dimensional Einstein space of positive curvature. And if you take one of these Kerr ADS type solutions and look to continue, you can connect it to YPQ. If you do a Kerr ADS solution with two independent rotation parameters, since there are two rotation planes in five dimensions, then you may end up with what they call the YPQR spaces. And the metric is not particularly illuminating, actually. So I think I'll basically wrap up. I mentioned a little bit about these five-dimensional Sasaki-Einstein spaces, partially because of recent interest. But there's been a long sort of old machinery on looking at manifolds of G2 holonomy. That shows up if you did 11-dimensional supergravity and you wanted to end up with a supersymmetric n equals 1 theory in four dimensions. What you want to do is compactify on a 7-dimensional manifold, and you want to go from 32 to 4 real supersymmetries. You want n equals 1 in 4 dimensions. So you need to have a space that preserves 1/8 of the original supersymmetries. And the 7-dimensional manifold with G2 holonomy will do that. And basically, the SO7 spinner is an 8-component spinner. And the decomposition of SO7 into G2 is basically the spinner 8 goes into 7 plus 1. So you have one singlet out of 8. And so people have taken the round 7 sphere, they've squashed the sphere, they've done a few different things with that. So I think I'm actually done today. And maybe I finished a little bit early. Next time I'd like to turn on some fluxes and start with the sort of Freund-Rubin compactification, which you could think of as near horizons of certain brains, or basically ADS times sphere solutions. And that shows that we can also discuss supersymmetric backgrounds with these sort of overall background fluxes turned on. I also looked a little bit at probably the M2 solution, just the membrane solution in 11 dimensions. There's lots and lots of membrane and string soliton solutions in supergravity, but it's probably not so fun to go through them all, just to give sort of the basics of the mechanics of how that works. And then I'll discuss some of the techniques for constructing these backgrounds, partially based on some of these techniques used to find these bubbling ADS type solutions. So good, I'll probably just stop here for questions. All right. So is Vijay going to talk?
Yeah. Don't forget that at 6:15 today, PJ is going to give another 1 hour lecture. And also, I have put up a webpage for the student talks. I link it to my website, so it is another